Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, the podcast, okay? And I'm delighted to say I'm once again with Ben Fletcher, the archer, the arrow man, call him what you will, but a distinguished broadcaster in his own right. And Ben, thank you very much indeed for joining me again today. Just heard the door click there.
Yeah.
It's people trying to interlope into the podcast. Anyway. Ben, on our last podcast, it was a bit of Porky Vision. Some people are really shocked at your ignorance of modern-day viewing, Ben, eh?
Well, not for the first time in my career. I'm a bit old-fashioned, perhaps. I like the old-fashioned ways. But you know what? I might give Poldark a go. I'll have a think about it.
Well, it's never going to be around again. What they did is, at the end of the last series, don't want to ruin it for anybody, is they left a door open, not for a new Poldark series, but for what I've been told by those in television as a spin-off series,
okay,
which could make bigger some of the minor characters in there. But anyway, that's from the time. Okay, folks, how does the offer of free beer sound to you? Pretty good, eh? Well, all you need to do is go to www.beer52.com/Porky. Have you got that? Beer 52. Don't forget it. Now, sign up within the next 2 weeks and get 2 extra free beers, a total of 10 free beers that will bring you. Beer 52 are the world's most popular craft beer discovery club, okay? Now, we deliver 8 craft beers with different themes every month, which have included California, Norway, Belgium, and Amsterdam, to name but a few, okay? Now, of course, I have personally tasted the beers. I particularly liked the top IPAs from Siren, Tiny Rebel, Magpie, Gwinu, Paradise, you name it. I have tried it. A Rising Tide Main Island Trail Ale is another one that particularly tickled my palate. Now then, folks, your first box will be sent to you the very next day and will contain beer from all over Europe. And as well as containing the beer, the best beer money can buy, you will receive a copy of the craft beer magazine Ferment and a cheeky little snack on the side just to make sure that your taste buds are satisfied as well as your taste for the beer, OK? Now, the people at Beer 52 traverse the globe to find the best and most interesting beers from all around the world. It's an abundance of beers you couldn't have imagined, really. Tailor your box to your own needs. Light or dark beers to your own tastes. Now, T&Cs apply, of course. One per household, new customers only, part of a monthly subscription with no minimum commitment. If you choose to stay, you will be delivered 8 craft beers, Ferment magazine, and a snack with free delivery for just £24. Just £24. Full terms at beer52.com/terms. And to get in on this, I'm telling you now, www.beer52.com/Porky. OK? Let me tell you that again one more time. www.beer52.com/Porky. I tell you what I want to talk to you about, Ben. In our business, it's fair to say, and I'm talking now about the media, OK?
Yeah.
We have influence in all sorts of ways.
Very.
Even when you are reading a sports broadcast, even when you are broadcasting on a long show, you will have a view on something, and that view, even if it's not specific, will be picked on by the listener, who will know which way you're going.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I'm telling you all this is because somebody died who I knew very well just last week, actually. His name was Tim Bell.
Yeah.
And people who don't know Tim Bell, who became Lord Bell, by the way, eventually, Tim Bell started off as a worker at Saatchi & Saatchi, the very famous advertising agency. Tim Bell invented the famous poster which got Mrs. Thatcher into power the first time. Labour isn't working, OK? 20 people from a local Conservative association in London lined up for a picture, and then they just looped the picture around in a snake-like procession away from an unemployment office with the title across the top, Labour isn't working.
That got one of the election, yeah.
The 1979 election when she was up against Jim Callaghan. And by the way, she had a rocky 2 years until the Falklands came through. And then he won two more elections for her, okay? But the point I was going to make is that why do I know so much about Tim Bell? Well, I was a senior executive on the Express at the time. So Tim Bell wins the 79 election. And he then helps her win the 83 election. By the 87 election, she needed a bit of help, but it was going to be her third election victory, and the opinion poll said she'd do it. But at that time, I'd become a senior executive on the Daily Express, and the editor was a man called Nicholas Lloyd. Mm-hmm. And what was so interesting was the Express was a Tory paper, and Nick only had one ambition in life, and that was to become Sir Nicholas Lloyd, without a shadow of a doubt. And he used to say to me when I had a few drinks, he said, wouldn't that name look great, Sir Nicholas Lloyd, as on the headed notepaper of British Airways, directors, you know, this man, Lord King, and Sir Nicholas Lloyd. That was his ambition. Nick was basically a pretty idle guy, but he'd done well, he's a working class boy, gone to Oxford University, got a degree, started in journalism on a lowly job on the Times or something, and so he became a Fleet Street star.
It's a strange thing to aspire to, just to become a sir. I mean, you and I think about achieving something. Yeah. Sir Mike Parry, I'm sure you'd be absolutely honoured, and Sir Ben Fletcher, but I want to actually achieve something before I got it. I wouldn't just think it's like fame for the sake of fame, do you know what I mean?
I think it's so devalued in ITIL these days when you give them to people like Andy Murray. Not that Andy Murray doesn't deserve one, but to give it him during his playing career.
Yeah.
I mean, Ian Botham, for instance, was retired 20 years before he got his knighthood. That's the way it should be.
Agree.
Look, you know, you look back on historical moments in achievement and you say that man now deserves recognition by his country. But anyway, what's so interesting here is that, I mean, the Daily Express literally became, it could have been called the Maggie Thatcher fan club magazine.
Conservative home.
Conservative home on a daily basis.
Yeah.
That's all it was, you know. And the thing was, Tim Bell, who then emerged from Saatchi, where he was creative director, into a self-fulfilling PR guru, okay, was leading the campaign for it. So this guy would come into our evening conference every evening, you know, he'd shuffle us around, and then tell us things that we didn't even know. And probably weren't even a story, but decided that as nothing good had happened to Mrs. Thatcher that day, we'd better invent something. Now, I'm not accusing him of inventing things that didn't happen.
Never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. But he would simply get on the phone, ring somebody down the street and say, we need to issue a government statement on this policy.
Mm.
And it went hand in hand. But the paper was being printed before the policy had been issued, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was dictating it. And that's the way the world works.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah. And so a bit like one time the Sun printed its own story. It was the Sun what won it, okay?
Was that 92?
Yeah, I think it was. You're absolutely right. That was when John Major was struggling a bit,
yeah,
and he got through. It was without a shadow of a doubt. Nick Lloyd, you know, believed that he had a, you know, hugely instrumental part in Mrs. Thatcher's third election victory, and as a consequence, got his knighthood. And I remember the day he got it. The knighthoods are issued in the honours lists, obviously. And they're printed in the London something. Is it the London Register or London?
It could well be. I'll have to bow to your superior knowledge on this.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's called the London Register, you know, which is a file published every day of the movements of the royal family and all that. And it issued. And we sent our political editor down to Westminster, where these things are published, came running back. Yeah, Nick, you've got a knighthood. And on the same day, Bernard Ingham got his knighthood because he'd stepped down as Mrs. Thatcher's in-house spokesman, you know, with Downing Street, you know, his press officer. And the two guys were there, you know, jerking it away and all that. And for Nick, this was, you know, this was the top of the world.
Absolute be all and end all, yeah.
And a few weeks later, Nick had a lunch in-house at the Express. The Express, by the way, used to be on a site on the southern side of the River Thames, southern side of Blackfriars Bridge. And it's not there anymore. That was our new building. I started on the Express in Fleet Street in the old Beaverbrook building.
Yeah.
Magnificent building. Didn't have the air conditioning and like that. Horrible building to work in, but now called the Black Lubyanka and a monument, right? Ended up in the second building, which has now been knocked down, if you see that gap, you know, there, and something else is being built. But we had a dinner in the boardroom. Nick had his knighthood around his neck. He'd been that day to Buckingham Palace to get it. And he was actually weeping as he was telling us. But that was it. You know, after that, he never did anything. So I don't want you to think about the honours system. You said a bit about it, but to me, that, you know, that job done.
Yeah, very much so for him. And you know, I can't really think of many people right now who are that hell bent on getting a sir.
No.
Or in.
Well,
in,
apart from David Beckham.
Well, yeah, but then he's delivered. You would argue. I mean, okay, he didn't win a World Cup, and you may argue that the England team of 2018 would be far more deserving. Yeah. But you raised an interesting point just then, talking about knightheads giving away too early during people's careers. Yes. I mean, for Andy Murray to have won one, and did I see that Alistair Cook got one recently as well?
Did he?
There was a cricketer. It may have been Andrew Strauss. There was a cricketer. In recent memory.
It might have been Strauss. Strauss was the head of the selectors, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, it might have been. I'm
chairman
sure
of the board.
It may have been Alistair Cook, but there was somebody who I just thought, look, great cricketer, great spokesman, ambassador for the sport.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like he's done his time on the public kind of circuit, if you like.
No.
Give it 20 years, like Beefy Botham, you say, get right to the end of their career.
Yeah.
That's when you do it, because as we've seen with other knighthoods in other industries, things can go very wrong if you go too early.
Of course it can, and been over the years, you know, men have been disgraced. You know, Gannex, remember the Gannex Air Lord, whatever his name was, associated with Harold Wilson, ended up in jail, and it happens. Now, what we've been listening to is, of course, the political situation is ongoing, isn't it?
Yeah, very much.
A couple of weeks ago, the current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, what did he do? Prorogued Parliament?
Yeah.
Yeah?
He said he's going to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely, and all that. Now, I was quite interested, actually, and I know this isn't pure politics, but pork pies, the Melton Mowbray pork pie. Fantastic. I love pork pies. What do you think of pork pies?
I love a pork pie.
Do you love a pork pie?
But, you know, I've got my father-in-law to thank for
this. Right, OK.
Pork pie, cut it in half. Bit of mustard,
yes,
just along the pork,
yes,
and that one, it was one Boxing Day about 8 or 9 years ago.
Do you have them cold or hot, by the way?
Cold.
Oh yeah, go on, yeah.
Oh, that's basically cold with a bit of mustard.
Yeah, yeah, good.
And it's been, I only ever have them or try and have that particular that served that way on Boxing Day,
right?
Because I look forward to it. But I'll have the odd pork pie if I'm at a service station or a hangover, rare occasion now, with the young children. But a pork pie is absolutely great. Melton Mowbray, various other ones. You get ones where they've got pickle actually sort of cooked into it in the middle. They're great.
Yes, that's right.
But
yeah,
I bloody love a pork pie.
I love a pork pie, and I eat quite a lot of them. Now, I like them hot as well as cold.
Okay.
Cold is not a problem at all. You know, most of the time you can cut it up and I'll have it in a salad with some tomato and beetroot and ham and all that. But you can't beat a hot pork pie. You warm it up and then all the juices in it sort of, you know, melt and all that kind of stuff. And I have that with a piece of crusty bread, butter and tomato ketchup. Now, you know, it's an absolute sin that pork pies are not allowed in America. But
why is that?
Well, you know, if you've flown to America, obviously.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
New York.
And you know you're given a form before you land asking you, you know, your identity, all that, and what do you bring with you? And you know they'll ask you, even if you've got a packet of English crisps, you can't bring those into the country. You can't take pork scratchings into America. They are so disciplined on any foodstuffs entering America which are not registered. And there are loads of food you can't take into America. Fish fingers from England can't go to America. They don't call them fish fingers in America. They call them fish, you know, fillet or something like that. You know what I mean?
Fillet-o-fish or something.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But the point of my story is, when we worked in America in the 80s, we had a mate called Peter the Pieman. His name was Peter Myers, and he came from Keswick, and he's a very, very proud Cumbrian, okay, Lake District and all that. And he's a butcher by trade, but he comes to America, you know, young man, makes a fortune, starts running works as a barman first, and eventually owns a pub called, what's it called? We used to go there and see him. The Bells of Hell Go... Yeah, the Bells of Hell, that's right. Yeah, the Bells of Hell Go ring-a-ring-a-ring. That's right. It's what the pilot used to sing in the Second World War.
Yeah.
So he gets it, and then he starts offering unique food, because he's a butcher. He started cooking English pork pies.
Oh, lovely.
Right?
That went down well.
Yeah. But he only had a small oven. So the British community started flocking there first, because we love our pork pies. But then the Americans used to hang around with the English journalists set in New York.
Mm.
Because they wanted to, because we were exciting and we produced tabloid newspapers which sold 4 million a day, you know. It was a phenomenon, and we were the best in the world at producing salacious newspapers and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? So then the guys that we'd mixed with in our local pub, which was called Costello's, would then follow us up to the Bells of Hell where Peter was, and they got into pork pies. All of a sudden, it became fashionable in New York to go to the Bells of Hell for an English pork pie, right? So Peter then thought, there's a business in this. So he then gave up the pub, and he went down into Greenwich Village.
Yeah, trendy part of New York.
Trendy part of New York, and it's where, for want of a better word, the buildings are flat. Everywhere else in New York, you've got huge, massive, you know, skyscrapers and all that. Down in the village, Greenwich Village, that's why that famous song was called The Village People, because yeah. the YMCA was down there. That's where people went to stay, right? But Peter then took a shop and called it Myers of Keswick, and he installed two or three big ovens in the back, and he started importing container loads of stuff from England, including Heinz baked beans. But he couldn't import the pork pies because of what Boris has been saying in the last couple of weeks. They were banned by American foodstuff regulations.
How about that?
So he started cooking them himself. That's why he first started at the Bells of Hell. This business took off. Peter's now a millionaire.
Unsurprisingly.
And he's got more than one outlet now. But his main customers were celebrities, like Keith Richards.
Yeah, like, oh, I bet, yeah.
Yeah, like Naomi Campbell. I mean,
really?
Oh, yeah,
I can't imagine her eating a pork pie.
No, but well, I think she'd get them to impress her friends, you know what I mean, and get back to her apartment, you want an English pork pie. So we'd go, sometimes after I'd left America, I'd go back, and either Peter would come uptown, or he'd say, no, come down to the shop tonight and we'll close the shop and have a few cocktails. You know, he had a couple of little tables where people would come and sit. And we'd say, oh. And then there'd be a knock on the door and Peter'd say, oh, and it'd be some famous English actor come for his pork pies for the weekend, honestly. So,
wow.
Yeah, so one night we're there, right, and the phone goes and Peter says, yeah, OK, well, I'm not sure I've got that many, but I'll see what I can do, you know. So Keith Richard had rung up and wanted 60 pork pies.
60?
Yeah, and Peter only had about like 40 in the fridge or the freezer or whatever. So he said he'd bring them up if it was a party on Saturday night, but they had to defrost the pork pies, and he'd do the other 20 tomorrow. So we went up together, OK? So we go up to Keith Richard's house, you know, really snazzy neighbourhood of New York. I don't even know where it was, because we got in a car and the pork pies were in the boot, you know, and we drove up there. But it was a great brownstone, you know, mansion in New York, probably...
Lovely.
Probably on the Lower East Side or something like that, you know, around about 10th Street or something like 11th Street, something like that. And it had a garden in the front, which is very unusual for a New York brown house, you know. So we go in, and we go through, and the maid opens the door, and we go into, you know, a huge hallway and all that, and said, oh, yeah, hello, Peter, thank you very much. Yeah, Keith says, can you go in and see him? So we go into the room, and Keith Richard is lying. I mean, it was so rock star visual. It was unbelievable. Keith Richard was lying on his couch, right, smoking a joint with a bottle of Jack Daniels in his right hand and his guitar leaning against the seat next to him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was literally, hey, man.
A picture.
Hey, Peter, you know, good to see you, man. Hey, you know, you sticking around, you know, yourself a joint or, you know, you have some Jack Daniels. And we stayed for about an hour, you know.
Brilliant. Did you imbibe?
Only in drink.
I was going to say. Well, my next question was, did you inhale?
Well, there was a lot of that going on when I lived there.
Yeah.
But I'd given it up a long time before and I didn't want to get into it again. The trouble is, and I know you're a clean living boy, and I was as well, but it's so much it went on in America. You just did, you know.
Yeah, of course.
But the moment you take your first puff of a marijuana cigarette, you're out the game for 12 hours.
Mm.
Doesn't matter how much you smoke, if it just one, just sends your head off and all that. And as I was there for a couple of days, I really didn't want to unbalance,
like,
you know.
Jet lag and that type of thing.
Jet lag, people to see, you know, wasn't always going to be here with Keith Richards and all that. We're going to go uptown, see people going out for dinner that night or something like that, you know. So you don't. But I mean, it was such a picture of, you know, rock star ism at its best, you know what I mean?
And excess.
A total excess, yeah. And for that reason, I'm very, very glad to hear the pork pies will be going back to America. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, in the first part of this particular podcast, we talked about that great man. Incidentally, the guy I'm talking about, Tim Bell, he was once spotted exposing himself to women from the lounge of his home. He went
really?
Sort of a bit mad. Yeah. It's, well, no. I mean, obviously the guy's dead. Can't sue anybody, but it doesn't matter. It was a well-recorded incident. And that's, I think, what, you know, when people get very big and important and all that, they kind of do. Now, I wanted to talk to you, please, Ben, about what we... One of these days, your children are going to grow up and they're probably going to go to school and then university. But do you think that in 15 years' time, and this is going to happen to you, that there will still be what I can call the middle-class conveyor belt? Your children go to junior school, then they go to senior school, then they go to university, then they try and find a job. Do you think that will go on forever?
Well, as long as people can afford to send their kids to university. I mean, it seems to be two annual salaries now. I mean, I was very lucky to go when I went. I was helped hugely by my parents. I think a lot of people generally are.
I got a government grant.
Yeah.
Didn't pay anything in my day.
Well, there you go. So there was a time when the government helped out a lot. I mean, I was very lucky that my father and my mother could sort of send me on the way in the way of tuition fees and then help while I was there. Had a part-time job, paid my way, but I was helped hugely. But it seems to be a lot more difficult now. So whilst I think university as an experience is very, very important for individuals, you know, you learn about yourself, you have some great times, you get drunk a lot, you experiment with various things, and you just make friends for life. But is it affordable? In a very that would be the question I have. But there will always be a class of people that can afford it. There'll always be a class.
But do you think
can't.
It's necessary? I mean, if your son came to you at 15 and said what John Lennon said to his aunt Mimi, "I don't want to go to university. I'd prefer to play the guitar," and she said, "John, the guitar's all right, it's a hobby, but you'll never make a living out of it, will you?" If you've got that moment when your son came to you and said, "Dad, I've just read a book about Lewis Hamilton, I didn't realise what a great racing driver he was, I want to be a racing driver," would you then say, "Right, my job now to support my son in what he wants to do"?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I mean, I guess I didn't know I wanted to go to university at the age of 15. It was after I'd done my GCSEs and we went to a fair, one of these fairs in the University of Surrey Halls, and you find out about courses, you think, "Oh, actually, I can go." And suddenly this world is open to you, very, very available and very, very possible. If my son turned around to me, either of my sons, and said, "I want to be a racing car driver or a footballer or a performer," and they were serious about it, and there was a way in which I could either influence it or support them, I guess I would say go for it, but not at the expense of an education. I think it's at that point when it becomes one or the other. And with something like, I mean, you hear so many people, you know, Ricky Gervais didn't find mainstream fame until he was in his late 30s, early 40s. Actors, sports is a bit different because obviously, you know, you peak in your younger years. So I'd hope that it would be something that they could sort of pick up at the same time as a full-time job and a career. And as with me getting into radio, I was very lucky that I was able to drop my, you know, fledgling career in marketing and do what I always wanted to do, which was radio. It's a tough question to answer because it depends what it would be. But if they were that serious about it and I could tell that they were destined for it based on their personality, based on their interest, then I think you'd have to back them, because I'd hate for them to spend the rest of their life begrudging the fact and resenting me for not letting them do it.
Exactly. You see, I never had that choice because I went literally on this conveyor belt. I went to a very good school, the King's School Chester, direct Grant Grammar School, and on the public school register, okay?
Sure.
Now, there was never a discussion about not going to university. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Everybody in the sixth form, there were two sixth form classes of... there were four sixth form classes of 15, so 60 of us all together. All 60 went into the UCA scheme, you know, University Council Central Admissions, and applied for the universities they want to go to. Not one person amongst my peers said, "I want to do something else." And it just wasn't even spoken about. I went for 1 year. I went to Trent Polytechnic to do urban estate surveying because my dad was a property... In fact, he wasn't an estate agent, a property developer. He used to sit in a house on a building site and sell homes to people at weekends. Mm. But it was in an age when property was very cheap and he might sell six or seven at a weekend. He made decent money. He thought, if you go and get some sort of degree in property... You know, you would become a member of the Institute of Chartered Surveyors, and therefore you could sign off valuations and things. The whole idea was we'd go together and create a business.
Absolute crust, yeah.
Yeah, but after 1 year, I just couldn't stand it. I didn't want to do it. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a journalist, you know. I worked on the Poly newspaper.
How did your dad react to that?
Well, he had no choice by that time. I was old enough then to make up my own mind.
Yeah.
And... you know, to say he was disappointed is not really true, because I told him it just wasn't for me.
Sure.
And it wasn't any point. And I think he might have come to the conclusion you've just talked about. What's the point in forcing my son to do another 2 years? And also, because I got a scholarship to the grammar school I went to, he couldn't throw it in my face that all that money I spent on your education. He didn't. He didn't have to, you know, and therefore I was able to make my own choice. I then became a successful journalist. My dad died when I was quite young. I was in my mid-20s, but I'd already made it to the Daily Express.
Yeah.
And that was his newspaper. And he'd seen my name from Mike Parry in New York in the Daily Express, which justified everything I'd done. Yeah. You know what I mean? But the point of the story is, ever since then, I felt if I ever did have children, if I had, I'd have given them the absolute choice of freedom to what they do. My nephew did the same thing. Very good school down in Bournemouth. University, 3-year course, geography, gap year, and then start work.
Mm.
And he's been trying to find a proper niche for himself in his life ever since. And I think if his parents hadn't too much pressure on him, he might have done something else.
And that's the thing, it's peer pressure. And it's not even in pushing people into a career like law or dentistry or doctors. I mean, let's not forget, Monty Python.
Yes.
You know, they were all dentists and doctors and
scientists. They all came from Cambridge. Yeah.
And they sort of sacked it all off. Right, they had the qualifications to fall back on, granted.
Yes.
But they became performers.
Of course
they
did.
They did it while they were at university and it was a love.
Yeah.
But they turned that into a career. It's interesting. I mean, you hear so often about parents at kids' football games pushing kids to hard, having a go at the referee, and pushing their kids so hard in a direction that they end up resenting it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I'd hate to do that. I don't want my kids to be a Premier League footballer. I mean, sure, the money come in very, very handy, especially by then.
Yes.
You know, 10, 15 years' time, they'll probably be on $1 million a week, which is a rare and wonderful thing even now. But, yeah, it's a tough one. You want them to do well. But I think increasingly, the more I look at my kids and the more I look at life, I just think it's a very, you know, fluffy view of the world, perhaps, but I just want them to be happy.
Yes.
And as our friend Danny Kelly once said, his dad once said to him, money doesn't make the world go round, but it comes in handy down Sainsbury's.
Yes.
And that's absolutely right. Yes. If you've got enough to sort of live the life that you want, a couple of nice holidays a year, invest in property, not to have to worry, that type of thing, whatever's going to float your boat, do something that you love. I'm very, very lucky to work in radio and do this sort of thing for a living.
Yeah.
You know, somebody that got told off at school for talking too much, and here I am, whittling away in the early hours of the morning about sport and things that I love, Woolworths and Woking and, you know, drinking and whatever it might be. It makes me very happy. I don't think my parents really pushed me in any particular direction. If they had done, maybe I could have been something different, a doctor or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's all about, I think, just leave them to it a little bit, let them follow their own groove, and then if it ends up that they're not going to really amount to anything and be a layabout, like we spoke about last time we were together, then that's a little bit different. But yeah, I think happiness is more important to me than forcing a career on them.
Sure. Even when I was sort of 18 and I was in Chester, my hometown, before I went to university, I earned enough money to buy a car because I worked all the time. I liked working. Yeah. I worked at a garage, you know, a petrol filling station where I used to run the thing. You know, the boss was always away, and I'd run it, and you know, and even then, I thought maybe I should not bother with university, polytechnic. I bought a car. I'm going to turn myself into a taxi driver.
Yeah.
So I can earn a lot of money because, you know, nightclubs in Chester were, you know, very popular. Always a demand for cars on Friday and Saturday nights. And I thought, why don't I do that? But that's one thing my father put his foot down and said, you're not doing that. You know, you didn't have an education to become a taxi driver. Taxi drivers were bums and all that. But I saw this week or last week a new plan to get us more bricklayers.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly girls, to get girls to take up IS, did you say?
That's an IS, as in IS.
Yes.
Yes.
And particularly women, because there's loads of women plumbers around these days.
Yeah, very much.
And they took that up. And that, to me, is a more noble calling than doing a degree in psychology. I've discovered studied all these degrees. A degree in psychology is worthless. You can't learn psychology. It's like going and doing a degree in songwriting.
Yeah,
you can either write songs or you can't write songs. How could you go and do a degree in batting, you know, for England?
Of course you couldn't.
You've either got it or you haven't got it. And apparently psychology is the same. You either understand the way that people function or you don't. But you can't read it in books. Books can only tell you about, you know, patterns of behaviour. But actually you've got to work most of it out yourself.
Mm-hmm. I can well believe it.
Yeah.
You don't learn to drive. You can learn the operations of a car, but you don't learn to drive until you get on the road.
Exactly.
Same sort of thing.
Totally agree.
But this £10 million pound campaign you speak about, an army of women bricklayers, I mean, we're living in an age now where I think kind of increasingly gender and certainly jobs, yeah. It almost isn't a thing.
Sure.
We've got female footballers sure. playing at World Cups.
Yeah.
You've got male men doing women's jobs yeah. as it would have been perceived traditionally.
Sure.
Hairdressers. My hairdresser is also a amateur boxer.
Right.
And you wouldn't have put those two careers together.
No,
but apparently,
you
but other people say, oh, that makes sense to me. People who know the game say it's about the concentration. It's about
yes.
the kind of, you know, I don't see it. But it's a very, very different era.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, I totally agree. I would much rather... I mean, for instance, a man who I have enormous respect for is Steve Morgan.
Yeah.
Not the Steve Morgan that you and I know who works in the media world, but Steve Morgan, who was head of the massive house-building company
yeah.
and once a director of Liverpool
yep.
and owned Wolverhampton Wanderers.
That's right,
okay?
Wolves, yeah.
What was it? Was it Bellway, his...
that sounds about right, the Bellway stand, Bellway, yeah.
Yeah, was that it?
I
Wolverhampton,
think it might well have
yeah,
been, yeah.
Something like that. Anyway, he certainly owned... He made himself a billionaire. And the way he did it is the entrepreneurial way that I most love. He got enough money to buy a small plot of land
mm.
and then borrowed £5,000 off his dad and built four houses on that small plot of land. And the way building houses works is you build them for price A and you sell them for price A plus 50%.
Yeah.
That's the way it works. I think the way it works is you pay a third for the land, a third for the building, and a third is your profit. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the way it works. He got onto that very early. But the amazing thing about that man is that he's now built thousands, if not tens of thousands, of houses in this country. And, you know, recently there's been other companies like Persimmon. I've bought a couple of properties off Persimmon, and I've not personally had a problem, but I've read about allegations of poor finishing.
Yeah.
You know, the window doesn't fit in, the window frame and the door lock.
You get like that with a new build, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's called a... it's not a checklist, it's whatever they call it at the end, and you go round it and...
The snagging.
Snagging, thank you very much. Snag list. I should have known that, because that's what my dad used to do.
Yeah.
He personally did all the snag lists for every property he's ever been responsible for, because he said nobody's ever going to come back to me
yeah.
and say that Steve Morgan built them a house that doesn't work. You know, I checked the central heating, I checked all the locks, I checked the windows and all that.
Mm.
And if he can't do it and he delegates it to somebody, because obviously when you're building thousands of houses across the country,
them, yeah.
if he gets one report back saying the snag list on that one wasn't done properly, it wasn't efficiently, that's the end of the guy's career
yeah.
in his organisation, because he went for perfection. Right, OK. Well, anyway, listen, Ben, thank you very much indeed. This is the third we've done recently, and we've had fantastic response to the last couple. Podcasting is something I've taken to. Thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Pleasure.
It gives you much greater freedom of expression. You and I are not outrageous. We don't swear a lot. I swear very occasionally.
It lapses occasionally.
We don't go into bad taste or anything like that. But there's a sense of freedom because we're not covered by the regulatory body Ofcom.
Yeah.
But, I mean, does it make any difference?
Not really, because it's just like, I mean, you and I could be doing this in a local alehouse
yes,
in the
because,
Soho
yeah.
area, and I hope
yeah.
in a couple of minutes' time we will be.
Yes, exactly. I'm sure we will. Right, OK, folks, you have been listening to Planet Porky with, I am delighted to say, my great colleague from radio, Ben Fletcher, The Arrow, The Archer, call him what you will. Pick up on all these, folks, every Tuesday and Thursday. You can get them from all good podcast distributors, including Audio Boom and Spotify, including iTunes and Apple. This is the future, folks. Stick with it. We're taking off on Planet Porky. So we go into the room and Keith Richard is lying. I mean, it was so rock star visual. It was
yeah.
unbelievable. Keith Richard was lying on his couch, right, smoking a joint with a bottle of Jack Daniels in his right hand and his guitar leaning against the seat next to him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was literally, hey, man.
A picture.
Hey, Peter, you know, good to see you, man. Hey, you know, you're sticking around, you know, get yourself a joint or, you know, you have some Jack Daniels. And we stayed for about an hour, you know.
Brilliant. Did you imbibe?
Only in drink.
I was going to say. Well, my next question was, did you inhale?
Well, there was a lot of that going on when I lived there.
Yeah.
But I'd given it up a long time before and I didn't want to get into it again. In the first part of this particular podcast, we talked about that great man, or great man. Incidentally, the guy I'm talking about, Tim Bell, he was once spotted exposing himself to women from the lounge of his home. He went
really?
Sort of a bit mad. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, obviously the guy's dead. Can't sue anybody, but it doesn't matter. It was a well-recorded incident. And that's, I think, what, you know, when people get very big and important and all that, they kind of do. A degree in psychology is worthless. You can't learn psychology.